You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 132, Conference Interviews, Part 5. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you doing?
Very good. We have another round of really good interviews.
We do. And real quick, Mike, I just want to let everybody know that I'm posting pictures that I'm taking during the interview. So if you'd like to go take a look at those pictures, you can get those at our website at nakedbiblepodcast.com. And it's going to be on each episode page.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm in the pictures. I got in the way a few times.
That's good. Those pictures are interesting. And also the pictures of our live event. Those are pretty good. Appreciate Nathan for taking those pictures. Those are the ones we're using. So we appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, our interviews this time around are going to be with John Walton. Again, he has a lot of fans in our audience, again, for good reason. John produces a lot of good stuff, again, intentionally, trying to produce content that is for the non-specialist. So we spent a little time with John talking about, you know, hey, why should we care about the ancient Near Eastern context? For what we do in the Old Testament and some of the things he's been working on. And then we are going to interview, we have interviewed Ben Witherington. Readers of the blog will recall Ben posted I think it was an 8 or 9 part review of Unseen Realm on his blog. Ben is a very famous and noteworthy New Testament scholar that, again, just like John Walton, tries to produce material that is digestible for the non-specialist, that matters, that's useful. And so we were really happy this year to be able to get some of Ben's time. I know he always has a lot to do at these events, a lot of filming and whatnot, but he was, you know, enthusiastically eager to give us a little time for the podcast. And then also, thirdly, Tremper Longman. I've referenced Tremper on the blog and, of course, on the podcast a few times. Tremper is an Old Testament scholar, and not surprisingly, again, he makes it part of his career, part of his ministry, to produce things that are not just for the elite, you know, the people that you know are at a conference like this. He doesn't just produce scholarship for other scholars, but trying to produce useful things for people who care about Scripture. So we talked to Tremper a little bit and see what he's working on. Our next interview from SBL will be with John Walton. Dr. Walton is very familiar to our audience. I talk about John's work a lot. I plug his work a lot. So here we have the man right here. But John, even though a lot of our listeners are going to be familiar with you, could you just give yourself a brief self-introduction?
Well, I'm John Walton. I teach Old Testament. I taught for 20 years at Moody Bible Institute and have been now 16 years at Wheaton College. And I write about the ancient world and how it helps us to interpret the Old Testament. I've been married 40 years, have 3 kids, and proud of all of them.
So that was a nice kind of neutral introduction. I write about the Old Testament and the context and help to interpret the Old Testament. John, you write about controversial stuff, okay?
Maybe.
No, a lot of our listeners have read, you know, your Lost World Genesis 1. That's probably the thing I see the most referred to. Secondarily, the Adam and Eve, and I always recommend, you know, the Ancient Near Eastern Conception. You know, the book that sort of covers everything. I want to ask you a question before we actually get to the newest book that you're interested in talking about, and that is, I asked Kyle Greenwood this the other day as well, who has the book on cosmology. We just take this as axiomatic. I mean, it never even enters into our mind anymore that this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to read the Old Testament and, oh, if we want to understand it, let's try to get the Israelite in our head. Let's try to think like they did so that we don't miss what they're trying to say. And we also don't put our own words in their mouth. I meet a lot of people though, that just don't, they don't get why you would do that. In other words, they don't even see this as a need, the whole enterprise. So when you encounter that, and I'm sure you do, mm-hmm. How do you try to convince people that what we're doing here is really important?
Well, I always tie it to the issue of biblical authority. Authority flowed through the authors, from God through the authors. And if people who read the Bible are interested in getting the authoritative word, we've got to get it through the authors. What people don't understand, they even forget that the Bible they've got in front of them has been translated from another language. Mm-hmm. But even when they remember that, they sometimes neglect the idea that it's also a culture that has to be translated. And so you need not only a translator, but what we could call a cultural broker to help us understand the ancient world. Mm-hmm. And so I think that people don't get it because they don't want to give up the idea that they can just sit down, open up their Bibles, and just read intuitively. Mm-hmm. And the point I try to make is that intuitive reading can be, it isn't always, but intuitive reading can be unreliable because we run the risk that we're just going to read our own culture and our own context onto the text. Mm-hmm. And that's imposing something on the text.
I always found your insider-outsider way of talking about this really helpful. Can you summarize that?
Sure. We come at the text as outsiders. The biblical authors were addressing their audience, and they were all insiders. They're inside that culture, inside that time. But we come to it as outsiders. And sometimes what the biblical author assumed his audience knew, we don't know. And so in that sense, we've got to try to come up to speed and understand that world. Now, on that same point, lots of people say, well, how can you imagine that we could ever understand that world? Mm-hmm. And the point I make is maybe we won't get so far into doing it, but we can understand enough of that world to know all the things in our world that don't belong there. And even if we can only just strip out the things that we keep trying to push into that world from our world, even if we can only do that, that's an advantage.
Yeah, that's worth doing, right? Well, that's a good segue to talking about a recent volume that you've edited that I'm sure you have high hopes for and looks like it's going to be very useful. So let's talk about that.
Well, that's the Cultural Background Study Bible. It's an NIV edition and so put out by Zondervan. And what we wanted to do is to provide lots of these notes, along with the Bible, that will help readers to understand that world. We, unlike other study Bibles, we don't do kind of theological notes and literary notes and here's what this word means and application notes. So those are all important, but we focus our attention on backgrounds. Now, that includes geography, history, archaeology, manners and customs, ancient literature, and in general, how people thought in the ancient world, so that readers can have that right at their fingertips as they read the biblical text in front of them. It's full of side articles, you know, one-page articles on different issues. It's full of photographs that help, full-color mm-hmm. photographs. And it's really just to help people get engaged in that ancient world and see what benefit it has to bring to the reading of the text.
How much of the material that has wound its way into the study Bible was drawn from the ZIBBC?
You know? Yes, ZIBCOT, the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Background Commentary of the Old Testament, that five-volume work. Basically, we started out by condensing that down, by taking what we thought were the most important entries, and of those entries, what are the most important parts of those entries. So kind of boiling that down to really be laser focused on the needs of someone who's using a study Bible.
Sure.
We added to that some information that we got from the IVP Bible Background Commentary, which they graciously made arrangements with us that we could use some of that material. And then after we got that all put together, then I went through and did some new writing and filled in some gaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've looked through it. And again, my impression was just what you said. I just wanted to sort of get a little confirmation there because for anyone who is familiar with that, again, you're gonna see some overlap here. But as John just said, there is some fresh writing there. There's sort of the top tier things, you know, most important things you need to know at any given point. Since we mentioned it, though, why don't you say something about the bigger set, the five volume?
Yeah, the five volumes under an Illustrated Bible Background Commentary. I was the general editor, and I had 30 experts, international scope of experts writing for that. And again, we were trying to enlarge on what was available in the IVP work. The IVP work was designed to be just one volume, and they basically told us no footnotes, no pictures. In the Zondervan work, that's why it's five volumes, yeah. Because we have 2,200 photos, and we've got 22,000 footnotes to take you into more detailed scholarly writing. So it ends up being kind of a starter that launches you into that world.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would certainly recommend both of those. I think, again, for our audience, you know, they're used to hearing this kind of thing. They're already over the hump of, oh, should we interpret, you know, scripture in its own context as opposed to some later context? They're already over that hump. So I would highly recommend the Study Bible. And again, once you get into that, I'm really thinking a lot of people are going to want to take a look, you know, at the set, which even though it's a set and you think, oh, I bet it's expensive, it's a set. You can actually get that, you know, for really, really good deals in CBD and things like that. It's not beyond the scope of what you're going to be able to afford, and you will mine it for information consistently. John, what are you working on now, if you can say, that you sort of have on your publishing calendar?
Yeah, let me talk about those things. But I wanted to say one other thing, okay. If I can quickly. Sometimes people worry that I might be imposing the ancient Near East on the Bible. And the point I want to make is that it's impossible to do that. The Bible is embedded right. in the ancient Near East. Right. That would be like saying I'm imposing Hebrew on the Bible.
Sure.
You can't impose Hebrew on the Bible. It's in Hebrew. And it's the same thing with the ancient Near Eastern cultural background. You can't impose it. It's embedded in it. Anyway, we're still following through with more books in the Lost World series. Mm-hmm. We've got The Lost World of the Flood that's coming, and that's about halfway through the writing process. I'm hoping it'll be out about this time next year.
Okay.
I'm doing that with Tremper Longman, so mm-hmm. we're working on that together. We also have Lost World of the Conquest coming, because the Conquest is a big problem and increasingly a problem today as it becomes the target of skeptics' attacks on the Bible. How can you worship such a God who would
sure.
you know, push genocide? And also a problem for Christians who say, oh yeah, what am I going to do about that? Wow, this is a problem. So, and again, like the other Lost World books, the basis of the Lost World books is we want to bring out the ancient Near Eastern background and a close reading of the Hebrew text and bring them together in an accessible way to address kind of modern issues.
Sure, sure.
And so Lost World of the Conquest, likewise, will certainly be out by this time next year. And so those are two more Lost World books that we're doing. I also have just finished a manuscript, the Old Testament Theology. And it's set up to be an Old Testament theology for Christians. Not because I'm reading Old Testament theology through New Testament, but because I believe that even before the New Testament comes along, and I don't think this should be terribly controversial, but even before the New Testament comes along,
give it a try.
that text had authority, mm-hmm. had authority in and of itself, and therefore there's theology there to be mined for Christians today. But to get to that, you have to first of all understand the ancient Near Eastern context in which Israel was embedded, mm-hmm. and then how God drew them out of that with the revelation that He gave to give them distinctives, and how through all of that process, theological messages emerged,
right.
Through the impetus of the Holy Spirit, and that those are still of enduring value to us today, and we need to understand them.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that we sort of forget that, as I like to say, God knew what He was getting. You know, when He prompts people to put together something, to write something, to edit something, whatever set of hands or hand that touched the text, it seems like we sort of forget providence when it comes to this. And I try to encourage people, try to think about inspiration the way you would think about canonicity. You know, we have no trouble taking what looks like a human enterprise, and, you know, there certainly it is a human enterprise, but we process that through the filter of providence, that God could actually do something as crazy as move someone to recognize a text that was inspired, that should be considered sacred. Well, why not look at it the same way? Again, I'm sure you'd be in agreement. When you strip out the humanity of the text, you actually undermine the doctrine of inspiration. You really make it vulnerable to various, you know, kinds of criticism. So, you know, we both have these experiences of where what we might say or, you know, recommend, you know, makes people nervous. But, you know, it's really important, because if you don't try to do that, just like you said, well, then you're putting words in their mouth. You're framing something that, you know, in a different way, and you're getting something out of it that they wouldn't have intended at all. You're not letting them speak, really, is what it comes down to. You're not letting the people that God chose speak.
You're making the message be something you want it to be,
yeah,
rather than something that is inherent,
right,
in the text.
It is, yeah. Yeah, and if God was happy with it, we might want to be happy with it too.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. Well, thanks for spending a few minutes with us. Anything else you'd like to have? I don't know if you have you started blogging or anything. We want to always give people a chance to promote anything that they want.
No, I don't blog. But maybe one other, I mean, one of the metaphors I've developed, and this is right in the front of the study Bible, mm-hmm. is I've been using the metaphor of the cultural river. That is, we have our modern cultural river that's got things like democracy and freedom and capitalism,
sure.
and market economy and individualism and consumerism and even social media. You know, it's all part of kind of, we can talk about our cultural
right.
river. We're in it. And we can't help but be in it. We didn't have to find it and get into it. We're in it. Sometimes we might say we don't like it. And we can try to swim against the currents or try to scramble out of the rushing water, but we're still in that river.
Yeah.
Well, likewise, there's an ancient cultural river, and it doesn't have any of the stuff in it that's in ours. And it has its own elements in the cultural river. And it's shared broadly. I mean, they all are different, but it's shared broadly by Babylonians or Egyptians or Assyrians or Hittites or Israelites. And again, God might be trying to draw the Israelites into a position where they're standing against that or swimming against it, but they're still in that river. And even
sure.
when they're swimming against it, they're in that river. With that analogy, I think the most important thing to recognize is that the Bible does not anticipate our cultural river. It always writes to that cultural river. And so it's not going to think about or present or suggest, its teaching, its claims can't be
right.
about the specifics of our
yeah.
cultural river. Certainly it's relevant to us because it helps us to stand, to take a stand mm-hmm. in our cultural river, but not by anticipating the river, but by transforming us. And I think that makes sense to people, because if you were going to say that the Bible anticipated our cultural river, you couldn't just say it's us. You would have to say it anticipated the medieval cultural river
right.
and spoke to that, and
right.
the Borneo Stone Age cultural
sure.
river and anticipated that. And
yep.
that becomes ridiculous.
Yeah, it does. It becomes absurd.
And so at that point, we say, okay, so the Bible did not anticipate all cultural rivers and not specifically ours. And therefore, we have to go and try to understand their cultural river. So I drew that analogy in the opening pages of the Cultural Background Study Bible, mm-hmm. and I gave about 12 different areas of the ancient cultural river, and just to give people a flavor for it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think you're right. That's going to be digestible. I think people will be able to grasp that and its implications. Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, thanks for spending a little bit of your time. I know your schedule's kind of chaotic here. Everybody's schedule seems to be chaotic, so we appreciate it.
Chaotic is what we do here.
Yeah.
We're seeking to develop order out of non-order. Anyway, it's great to chat with you, Michael.
Yep, thanks. We're back at SBL, and with us this time is Dr. Ben Witherington. Ben is a noteworthy New Testament scholar, does a lot of blogging, tries to, again, he's on the short list of those scholars who really makes an intentional effort to get content to the non-specialists. And so I've referenced him on the blog a lot, but now we get to meet him. So Ben, could you introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. I'm an old New Testament professor at this point. I've been at this for 35 plus years teaching biblical studies and actually Wesleyan studies, not just biblical studies, but it was kind of funny. 20 years ago, I went to Asbury, and having been teaching Old and New Testament and intertestamental literature and Wesley studies and apologetics at Ashland Seminary, and I got to Asbury, and they said, "Now, which part of the New Testament would you like to teach? And I said,
yes.
At least that, yes. So I've been very blessed to have a good teaching career in various places. And right now, I'm especially enjoying having doctoral students in biblical studies. We've got 30 folks in the program, and they're all sharp and challenging and stimulating. So that part of my life is very full, lecturing for them and working with the doctoral dissertations and all of that. But I continue to do a good deal of writing. The most recent thing that's hit the bookstalls is the Lightfoot Legacy series, 3 volumes of unpublished manuscripts by J.B. Lightfoot.
Right, right. Now, what? Let's talk about the blogging a little bit, because you've been an online presence for quite a while.
Yep.
So what attracted you to that? You know, at a time when, you know, most people in biblical studies, but most academics generally, are not thinking about, oh, you know, this new thing called blogging, let's do that.
Yeah.
What attracted you to that?
Well, initially, BeliefNet came after me back at the dawn of time when the earth was still cooling in the early 21st century, and said, well, we need a Bible answer man who would answer questions and maybe do some blogging. And I mean, I've been involved in culture for a long time. I'm a musician as well as a writer, and I was always interested in the interface between faith and culture. And so I said, well, I'll do a Bible and culture blog for you, because, you know, I do a lot of reviews of movies and books and this, that, and the other, and it seemed a natural thing to do. So I had sort of 2 incarnations for them. One was the Bible Answer Man, and the other was my blog dealing with the Bible and culture. And that's just continued. I moved to Patheos, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. And, you know, it's been good. And you're right. I mean, social media has grown enormously in the last 10 years in various ways. One of the reasons I was interested in this is because, I mean, my own forebear, John Wesley, said the world is your parish. For me, what that meant ethically is by any means necessary that were ethical to reach people for Christ and for the gospel. And so I committed myself to doing that. And for me, writing is easy. I don't sweat bullets writing. So writing a blog takes 15 or 20 minutes for me. So, you know, no big deal.
What are some of the current things last? Oh, let's make it the last couple of weeks. Just give people an example of the range of the stuff that you'll blog about.
Well, what I've been blogging about this fall is about some unpublished manuscripts of my doctor father, C.K. Barrett, a famous Methodist New Testament scholar who passed away in 2011. I am transcribing his remarkable sermons that are both thoroughly biblical and thoroughly Wesleyan in their theological orientation. And really, there's not much like them out there. So what I've been doing is giving previews of coming attractions. We're going to publish 2 volumes of his sermons, 100 sermons on the Gospels and Acts, and more than 100 on the rest of the canon. And so I've been giving little quotations from him and snippets from some of the sermons, and there's been a good deal of reaction to that.
Now, when you say transcribing, this is from audio?
No, it's his notebooks. He wrote out all of his sermons in longhand, verbatim, with topics, with headings, and with a page that told exactly where he preached all these in the British Methodist circuit. Because the way Methodism worked in the UK is it's musical chairs in the pulpit. So he would preach 2 or 3 times a week in different little Methodist chapels. Wow. And so some of these sermons he preached between 40 and 60 times over the course of 1934 to 2009. He preached in 7 decades.
So did you find these? Or
no, his daughter had them. She had a cardboard box full of his multitudinous little sermon notebooks, and she sent them to me because we knew each other, and she wanted to see somebody publish them, and and Whippenstock was very happy to oblige. So we're publishing 2 volumes of his sermons, and then his father was the Billy Graham of British Methodism in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. going all over England in horse and buggy, evangelizing the UK. So we have his sermons as well. So we're going to publish some of them. And for those of us who are from that faith tradition of evangelical Wesleyan biblical preaching, this is like a gold mine for us. Oh, sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, that's a huge project and really significant. I mean, I'm in Semitics, but everybody knows Barrett. You know that.
Well, see, I went over there to do my PhD with him. I turned down Oxford and went and did my PhD with him in Durham, and I'm so glad that I did. But I only knew him as like an author, a New Testament scholar, a lecturer. I'd heard him preach occasionally, and they were excellent. But I didn't realize that his teaching and his writing were only the tip of the iceberg of his ministry. The majority of his ministry was writing sermons every week and preaching two or three times a week. I had no clue that that was the majority of his ministry. And so now I have figured this out. And so it's exciting. And it's exciting for me to hear the voice of my doctor father again. So,
well, that's a big deal. I mean, let's be honest, that's a big deal to put that out.
It certainly galvanized me. I've gotten all excited because sure. I've heard so much bad Methodist preaching and superficial Methodist preaching and annoying Methodist preaching.
This is what it ought
preaching.
To be and used to be.
Exactly. And, yeah. This is what it's supposed to look like. And his great gift was be able to distill complex theological and ethical ideas to any level of discourse. So he was mostly preaching this to 45 working-class Methodists in a pit village around Durham or Darlington again and again and again. And he was happy as a clam to do that. That's an important part of his calling. In one of his sermons, he actually says, when I went to Durham in 1945, I thought, I'll give this a go for 3 or 4 years and then get back to the circuit. Well, he never left the circuit. But he continued right. to be a professor the rest of his career.
Wow. What about, I don't even think I can really ask, aside from that, what are you working on? Because that's a huge project.
It is, but it's a heart project. It's a fun project, and it's not hard. It's just transcribing and annotating a little bit. I've just finished a book for Fortress called Isaiah Old and New on intertextuality, where I'm reading the Old Testament forward and also backwards. I'm reading it in its original context, being fair to that. And then I'm reading it in light of how it's used in the New Testament. So Isaiah Old and New is coming out with Fortress in February. And then the second volume is with the press, the Psalms Old and New. And then they said, well, now you have to do one on the Torah. We need the law Old and New because there's a lot of Deuteronomy in the New Testament, you know. So the next project down the road is to do those passages in the Pentateuch that show up as a citation, allusion, or echo in the New Testament.
Now, are those technical? I mean, describe, what's the target audience?
Yeah,
for
it's mid-level.
Okay.
It's like most of my audience, it's for the educated layperson, it's for the pastor, it's for the keen Bible student. And, you know, I try to write at a level of clarity that anybody with some background in biblical studies could get benefit. It's not, these are not technical monographs. They're more sort of introducing that whole audience to the idea of intertextuality and how that affects biblical theology, those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's a big deal for my audience because we do intertextuality on the blog. I mean, right now we're going through Ezekiel, and so that's always a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, what are the touch points? How does this hook into that? When the writer uses this word or this phrase, again, just to get people to realize they want you mentally to go someplace and pick up that thought and then come back. And so yeah, if they're pitched at that level, I mean, I'm happy to recommend them here.
Yeah, that's important. Exactly right. Because, you know, in an age of increasing biblical illiteracy, one of the things that's clear to me is most preaching is soundbiting. You know, take sure. a few words, yeah. a verse or two here or there, and milk it for all it's worth, which is not necessarily terrible, but it can be distorting. And so increasingly, I've been concerned about whole canon understanding, progressive revelation, all those kinds. Some of the same things you're interested in the unseen realm. You know, I've been very concerned about having enough of a macro context that when you deal with the micro material, you know where it fits
in
the bigger picture. And and that's one of the reasons for doing this. The other reason I did it is there is a lot of stuff out there about intertextuality that has a theory of meaning and a presupposition about epistemology that I absolutely would not agree with. For example, the idea that texts don't have meaning, that meaning is in the mind of the beholder. I absolutely don't agree with this theory of meaning. So one of the things I'm doing is saying yes to intertextuality and no to that approach to meaning.
Well, that sounds great. As those kinds of things roll out, I mean, like I said, I'll be interested in getting them and going through them so there's Isaiah and
Isaiah's coming out in February and then the Psalms in the fall. And if I have any spare time in the summer, I'm going to start on the Law, Old and New, in the summer.
Right. But,
and all of this is propedeutic to doing a proper biblical theology, because I've done a New Testament theology twice over. And I finally got to the point where I was very dissatisfied with the biblical theologies that are out there. Mm-hmm. We have a new one from John Goldengay, as you know, and I will have to go through that. But knowing his hermeneutic and knowing his shtick, I'm probably not going to agree with a good deal of what he's going to say, which is the Old Testament says what it says and the New Testament writers bless their hearts. They really didn't get it.
He has that short little book. I'm trying to remember what table it was at, but it's either Do We Need the New Testament? It's something like that.
Yeah, it is. Need the New Testament?
Right, I look through the table of contents, and it's like, well, I guess your answer is no.
Yes, it could be a very short book.
Right. It is. It's about this.
So thing. I want trying to work my way towards a proper biblical theology. I've taught Old Testament long enough and New Testament long enough that methodologically and in regard to other things, one of the keys to even being able to think about that is intertextuality. What is the relationship between the old and new, and how is the old used in the new, and how does the old prepare for the new, and all those kinds of questions. And I figured I need to have a real good handle on that before I even jump into the swimming pool called biblical theology.
All right. So these books are essentially going to be illustrations of how this is done. You know, lots of examples, working through a book.
Right.
So what would you recommend to people, again, pitched at my audience, which I like your description. It's one I use. The educated layperson, the layperson who cares, has enough Bible under their belt, so to speak.
Right.
What would you recommend as far as a book introducing people to this concept broadly? And you brought up method.
Yeah.
What would you recommend there?
Well, one possible point of entry that it will at least tease the mind into active thought is Richard Hayes' little book, Reading Backwards.
Okay, and that's pretty recent, too.
That's very recent. Yeah. I have a review of it in the appendix, one of the appendices to the Isaiah book. And it's a good book. I don't entirely agree with him about how this would have been received. I mean, he presupposes a significant quotient of the audience is learned in the Old Testament.
Right, yeah.
I don't think that's likely to be the case. Maybe one or two people. I mean, what I know about literacy in the New Testament era, it doesn't encourage that kind of view. And what I know about his largely Gentile audience also doesn't encourage that view. So some of the things he does with metalepsis, the British would say, is too clever by half. This would be way over the heads of Joe Gentile going, I didn't get that. Yeah. What was that Isaiah thing, and so, I think it's fascinating. I think he asks the right questions, but I also think that he is suggesting that the New Testament writers presuppose a lot more out of their audience than the way they portray the disciples in the Gospels, for example. I mean, I call the disciples in Mark the disciples because they just regularly don't get it, right? And I've reckon that was pretty typical for a high level of discourse with like take Isaiah 9 through 11. You have like 43 citations from Isaiah and other portions of the canon. This is like eating marzipan. I'm thinking average Joe Gentile Christian in Rome is going, help, I don't get this, you know, and, and they didn't have all these scrolls in front of them from the Old Testament like we do. So, I mean, there's some of those kinds of issues, but it raises the right questions about orality and the importance of the Old Testament for Christians going forward. And those are all the right questions to ask about all of that.
Yeah, I often find myself saying either on the podcast or something else that, you know, the qualifier, a literate, person would have understood this or would have seen this connection. But you're right, and that's a limited audience. And the other people are really dependent on how good were their teachers, whoever they were,
exactly.
whether they be parents or rabbis or something.
Right.
So it's going to be a little bit of a scattershot, hit or miss proposition. But.
Well, to me, one of the aha moments was when I looked at the use of the word anagnoskein in two places in the New Testament, in Mark 13, let the reader understand, and more importantly, in Revelation 1, 3, and 4. In both cases, the reader is not the audience. The reader is a lector who is reading to the
audience. Yeah.
Right? Which presupposes an audience that's basically oral and aural and probably can't read in detail this stuff, needs to be told this stuff. Jesus didn't say, let those with two good eyes read. It's not like our situation today where everybody's reading blogs and reading the internet and all that. Jesus said, let those with ears hear. Well, it was primarily an oral culture and writing was secondary. So the question is, how does a sacred text function in a largely oral culture? It's those kind of questions that really interest me.
So last question, I want to ask you a little bit about apologetics, and we can see some of this coming through on your blog.
Yep.
What do you think, give us an example or just tell us generally kind of how you approach the postmodern mindset. What do you think is effective?
I think we have a mixed group of people out there. I think we have pre-modern people out there. I think we have modernist people who think in modern ways. And yes, we have postmodern people out there. I think it's a wrong generalization to say, well, we're in a postmodern situation. Well, frankly, quite a lot of Americans haven't gotten the memo. They think in very modernist ways about things ranging from miracles to sacred texts, So it depends on the audience. But what I have found, having done a bunch of apologetics conferences with the Talbot folks and with Bill Craig and some of those folks, is that many of those philosophical apologetes are not really coming to grips with the difference that postmodernism, for example, in the Pacific Northwest makes to the way people think about these issues. And so a lot of what passes for evangelical apologetics is arguing in a way that will be profoundly unconvincing to a postmodern person. You know, here are the six proofs for the existence of God. Well, okay, that's a nice little logical miniature circle, right? Not impressed, So, in terms of apologetics, what I say is you have to know your audience. Now, so I watch some of the culture shapers that people actually listen to within both the evangelical community and much more broadly. I mean, for example, why has Rachel Held Evans garnered such a humongous audience through blogs and through her books and whatnot? What is it that she is saying that is appealing to all kinds of people? That would be one example. Or why has Andy Crouch done so well with his culture-making books? What's that about? I think you have to learn by having a detailed study of keeping your ear to the ground with the culture and asking what works and why, those kinds of questions. I think we're tremendously unprepared for the growing hostility against Christianity in America.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That's unfortunate. Well, thanks for spending a few minutes.
Sure.
We know it's chaotic here. We've had a whole week of it ourselves, so we're grateful you could do it.
Well, my pleasure, and thank you for what you're doing, because I think you're forcing many more sort of rationalistic evangelicals to think seriously about the supernatural And I think that's so vitally important because, as you know as well as I do, the growing part of Protestantism worldwide is Pentecostalism. And there's a reason. They take demons seriously.
Right.
You know, they actually believe in card-carrying demons. And so thank you for your work. I think it's very important.
Thank you. Our next interview at SBL is with Dr. Tremper Longman. This is another name that our listeners and readers of my blog have heard of before. And it's great to spend a little bit of time with Tremper. But why don't you introduce yourself briefly, and then we'll get into some things that readers would be interested in hearing about.
Sure. Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here with you and see you again and be at SBL and before that IBR, which organization I'm very involved with. But I'm a longtime professor of Old Testament, presently the Robert H. Gundry Professor of Biblical Studies at Westmont College. And I'm retiring at the end of the year, but I'll stay very involved in the field, moving to Alexandria, Virginia to be near kids and grandkids.
Oh, wow. I didn't know you were retiring. So
yeah.
That's news. Do we need to edit that out? Or? Wow. I didn't realize that. Well, you brought up IBR. We should say something about that to promote the society. But tell us a little bit about IBR. What's different about it from ETS and SBL? Because those are the two that people are going to know.
Sure. So IBR stands for the Institute of Biblical Research. And I've been very privileged to serve as the president for the past 4 years. And I have two more years on my term. It's a affiliate organization of the SBL. Its purpose, and it was founded back in the late 70s by Earl Ellis and some other leading evangelical scholars of that day, was to serve as a organization where scholars who wanted to do work in the context of faith, particularly in evangelical faith, which can be Protestant, Catholic, or Orthodox evangelical faith, can get together, network. We have an annual lecture. We have about 700 members now, very close to 700 members. We've grown dramatically lately as more and more scholars want to network in an organization like ours. So very excited about all the things that are happening. And you can go on our website, which is www.ibr-bbr.org. We have publications, et cetera.
Yeah, and this is the same BBR. I've had two articles published in BBR, and readers and listeners will know and recall, some brief posts about that. So This is the agency behind that journal, and it's quite a good journal. So, anything we can do to maybe get some people to subscribe to the journal, that would be a good thing to do if you're interested in biblical studies. And also just to, follow the progress of IBR. You have an affiliate associate membership too, right?
Something
like that.
Of SBL or?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, right. Yeah. To be a fellow, you need a PhD in biblical studies and to be an associate, you could be on your way to getting a PhD, but we also have student memberships as well as friend membership.
Okay.
So they're different, and it's all explained on our website.
Right.
Yeah. Right. We'd love to welcome people who want that kind of interaction.
Yeah. And, hopefully we'll get you a few more of those. So let's talk about your work. Again, I've referenced your books either on the blog or in the podcast at some point. So what is sort of recent that we could recommend for listeners to go out and buy and benefit from?
Thank you. My most recent published book is a commentary on Genesis, which is in a new Zondervan series called the Story of God Commentary Series, which Scott McKnight and I are co-editing. Of course, I'm focused in on the Old Testament. And you might ask, why do we need another commentary? There are a couple of unique features of this series that I think your listeners will be interested in. One is it's concerned not only with what the texts means in its original setting, but what that, what significance that meaning has for us today, how it relates to us today. And also in terms of the Old Testament, part of that is that every book of the Old Testament will offer, after looking at the message in its Old Testament setting, will consider that book and different sections of the book, its Christological significance, taking seriously Jesus's words in Luke 24 about how all of scriptures look forward to him. So we've chosen a wonderful group of scholars to write the volumes in the Old Testament. Mine's the first one out. Wendy Witter's Daniel just came out this month, and Proverbs is by Ryan O'Dowd's about to come out. So the New Testament series is a little bit further along, but that I had the privilege of designing the series for the Old Testament, varying for Old Testament purposes the design that Scott McKnight had for the New Testament. And I think particularly preachers are going to find it helpful as they want to preach Christ from the Old Testament to give them some ideas about how to do that.
Right, right. And how to legitimately do that.
Right, right.
Just
sort
of making
we're
stuff
not,
up.
We're not doing the allegorical kind of reading. So so I'm very excited about the series as a whole.
Yeah, that's great. I ran into Wendy yesterday, and she gave me a golden ticket.
All right.
So
oh, good.
I have to go pick
excellent.
Up for Daniel.
Yeah.
She says, I quote you in chapter 7.
Yeah,
you better go get that.
Of course she does. And, Wendy did a wonderful job. You know, I read it in manuscript form. And Proverbs is great, too, by Ryan.
Well, that sounds like a great series. What else do you have either already out or in the pipeline?
The next thing that's out is a book on wisdom. I've written commentaries over the years on all the wisdom books and other books that may not be wisdom but are filled with comments about wisdom, like Proverbs and Job and Ecclesiastes and Psalms. So now Baker asked me to do a more synthetic work. So in the summer, that book will come out. It's called The Fear of the Lord is the Beginning of Wisdom, a Theological Introduction to Wisdom in Israel. And we start in the Old Testament, but again, I talk about wisdom in the New Testament, also wisdom during the intertestamental time period, both in the Apocrypha and in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they even have an excursus there that talks about wisdom in the 21st century. So I go from the Old Testament to today.
Oh, great.
But the latter's just pretty suggestive, raising some...
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Anything that we should look for on the horizon?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually, in my retirement, contracted to write about 4 or 5 books. Maybe one of the ones your listeners might be interested in is a book that doesn't have a title yet, but even though I'm pretty far into it, but it's basically about the controversial issues in the Old Testament, which would include sections on historicity issue. Does it matter whether the Exodus and conquest took place? On divine violence. What do we do with God's command to Moses and then Joshua to go in and
conquest narratives?
And creation, evolution, sexuality, slavery, and patriarchy. So those are,
right.
So
basically, you know, this is going to be sort of your take or your response to a lot of the things that, you know, in the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you know, other people have come out with books and that have kind of rattled some cages.
Right, right.
Evangelical cages anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as you know, one of my best friends, former student colleague is Peter Renz, whom I love dearly as a friend. And we interchange ideas all the time. But I'm going to challenge some of the ways he thinks about these issues, very ironically, because I know his heart, like a lot of people don't. I mean, he's really trying to help people grapple with these difficult issues. But yeah, so and Pete and Kent Sparks know I'm writing this book, and I'm going to let them read it while I do. And
you're not going to surprise them with it.
No. And
like a photo bomb book or something.
Well, personally, I think one of the sad things about our evangelical world is that we tend to demonize people who disagree with us and go after them in negative ways that aren't helpful to further the discussion.
Right.
Besides that, I know that my book isn't, there'll be something in it that will make everybody on whatever side they are. There'll be one issue they'll say, yeah, Longman has it right. And another one, like, is he nuts? Yeah. So I'm trying to write it in a scholarly way, in the sense that, you know, my 30 or 40 years of scholarship will be behind it, but in a kind of very accessible way, because especially Pete writes so well in that vein. That I'm not going to mimic him. I can't. You could really see his personality come through, but I do want it to be an accessible kind of presentation on these issues.
That kind of thing is needed, where you can offer pushback. And again, a lot of people are going to know, at least within the academy, that you guys, you know, have a relationship.
Yeah.
You're not shooting at each other. You know, it's a discussion.
Right.
You know, it's an actual discussion.
Right. Right.
As opposed to an ambush or a gotcha, you know, kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of thing ought to actually be done more.
That's, you know, more that's often. My feeling as well, Michael. Yeah.
I'm surprised a publisher hasn't sort of, you know, leaped on that to, in other things, because, you know, you come to the meetings, you talk to people.
Yeah.
Oh, right. I have a friend that disagrees with me. Well, why don't you two do something together or respond back and forth?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, Rich Mao is a good person who speaks into that kind of attitude, trying to encourage civility in, you know, because not just in our circles, but in political realm and others, there's so much nasty talk that doesn't get us anywhere. So, so that is my hope with this book. And then I'm also writing a commentary on Revelation. Because there's
now you really have gone over the deep end.
Yeah, I know. But who better to write a commentary on Revelation than an Old Testament professor, right? Yeah.
Of course. It uses the Old Testament so much.
Yeah, right.
Why not?
Right.
That's fair game.
Your book will be very helpful, is very helpful to me as I think through a lot of the issues in Revelation. Yeah, it's actually a series that Kriegel's doing called The New Testament Through Old Testament Eyes.
Oh, okay. So, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that would be a good series. Well, hopefully this time next year, I don't think we probably can't count on the one that's sort of a response to Pete.
Right.
You know, being out, because it takes a while for these things to get up and running and edited and whatnot. But some of these other things, you know, will be right there at the forefront, and you'll probably be on to something else.
Yeah, there are two or three I'll mention next year.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for spending a little time with us.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
Well, Mike, that was three great interviews. I enjoyed Walton. He's another character. I enjoyed his interview. That was pretty fun. And then Witherton, he's a character too.
He is a character. He really is.
All you scholars are a bunch of characters.
Yeah, I'd say we let our hair down, but we don't really have a whole lot of hair. So, you know, it's an event like this. It's great just to come and you see who these people are. And by and large, they're just normal. You know, they like to have fun, too.
Yeah, I grew my beard out to see if I'd go all mountain men on the you scholars here to see if I could do that. But I've seen some impressive beards here myself. So.
Yeah, well, you forgot your tweed.
Yeah. All right, Mike, well, we appreciate it. And look for part 6 coming up after our live from San Antonio episode, which is going to be released next. But then we've got one more conference interview episode left. So be looking forward to that. And I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.